Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and all around the world in business and politics. And it's a bank holiday, so hopefully you're enjoying it. And we have a general election on the horizon. And in a general election, we often hear politicians talking about having yet more bank holidays. But how much do they actually cost our economy? Well, it's been estimated that one day's annual holiday can actually account for 226 million. Edward Thomas Jones is a lecturer in economics at Bangor University. He's been looking at the global data around the issue of public holidays, and we'll be finding out later what he discovered. Also on today's show, as the US elections come into its final days, by now you're going to be familiar with terms like swing states, faithless voters and electoral college. Well, the US voting system is actually a really, really complex one. So today we're going to try and explain it all to you. Sam Levine is from the Guardian newspaper, and he's going to be here to take us through the role of the electoral college system and how it actually started in the first place. And in our techscape this week, it's all about crypto, as the Coulson brothers spend over $1 billion buying US crypto platform Bridge. It's their move into stable coins. What fresh hell is this, I hear you ask? Well, Charlie Taylor of the Business Post and Jemima Kelly from the Financial Times will be here to try and tell us what that's all about. You can email me, as always, at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. So let's start today with this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
Yes, as I mentioned in the introduction, Stripe confirmed its biggest ever acquisition this week. $1 billion deal to buy US crypto platform Bridge, accelerating their move into stable coins. Well, to look at that issue and also look at the role of cryptocurrency and where it all stands now, I'm joined by Charlie Taylor of the Business Post and Jemima Kelly, who's a columnist with the Financial Times. Jemima and Charlie, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you.
Hello there.
Charlie, I'm going to start with you and that deal with the Coulson brothers there. What exactly is a stable coin and why are they getting involved in this now?
Yeah, good questions, one and all. I suppose let's start off, this deal is worth noting. This is by far and away Stripe's biggest ever acquisition. It tends to usually snap up sort of small startups at a relatively low cost and, you know, whose technology it can easily integrate into it. So this marks a significant sea change for them in terms of their acquisition strategy. It's a huge deal. You know, $1.1 billion is massive in terms of, you know, not that they can't afford it, but it still marks a big change in terms of what they're doing. And I think it really seems as though it's in some ways a sort of land grab by them into the move of stable coins. Now, everybody knows what sort of Bitcoin is the most famous sort of cryptocurrency that's around. And as we all know, it has a generally quite a poor reputation. It's seen as being very volatile. It's also been used in sort of scams and in the past it's been used for sort of dodgy transactions. So it doesn't have the greatest reputation. Whereas stable coins, as the name suggests, offer some much more stability than other crypto. It's assets that are pegged to traditional currency such as the dollar. So it means that they sort of, it's stable all along is really what it's about. And I think really, if you like, it's becoming sort of the acceptable face of crypto. It's sort of a bridge in between sort of traditional currencies like the dollar and then the more sort of volatile ones like Bitcoin.
Mm. And the Coulsons themselves have kind of changed their position when it comes to dabbling in crypto. I know in 2018, they ended their support really for Bitcoin. So what's changed for them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they have an interesting track record in terms of the fact of like that when they started out, which was 2010, they were a very early supporter of crypto and, you know, seemed to back it all the way and were keen sort of backers of it. But yeah, as you say, 2018, they stopped backing it because they just sort of said, look, it's become more of an asset that's traded rather than a means of exchange. But, you know, so they sort of withdrew from it, but it was only for a short time because even just a couple of years later, they were back in with it, building a team to take advantage of what it said was to build the future of Web3 payments, which are sort of, you know, back embracing crypto, if you like. And I suppose, you know, their move back into it is very much sort of, part of it is just due to the fact that, you know, it's demand from customers. Customers are starting to demand stable coins more. So they obviously want to meet the need of their customers, but also they and many other fintechs are also getting in on the stable coins for issue. You've had like the likes of Revolut that are considering issuing a stable coin, Visa, PayPal. They're all looking at it as something of interest to them. And even if you look beyond that, you know, the wider context is also, you know, we can't look at this, I think, without looking at the US election that's taken place. Is Donald Trump has reversed his position on digital assets. He was very against them. Now he's come out as a big supporter of them, which in turn has led the big tech bros to embrace him and sort of offer their support for him. And, you know, his opponent has not been someone who's publicly been as positive about crypto as Donald Trump, but is seen to be wooing supporters behind closed doors. So I think whichever way the election goes, it looks as though crypto is going to become more mainstream. Mm. And stable coins are very much sort of the acceptable way into embracing that and ever to becoming a reality.
Yeah, and maybe look, their real allure is that they're pegged to traditional currencies and people feel a bit more secure in investing in something like that when there's something tangible there. Jemima, can I bring you in now and we'll come back to stable coins a bit more. But that issue that Charlie has mentioned a couple of times of, you know, the arc of cryptocurrency, if you like, we've come a long way, really, haven't we, from where it started. It's maybe just take us through the trajectory of their journey and where you see it is now. I know you've written a piece quite recently that said crypto is now boring, but that doesn't necessarily make it safe or regulated.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess when Bitcoin was started by this person or group calling themselves Satoshi Nakamoto, we still don't actually know who that is, although there was an HBO documentary recently that did suggest that it was someone, but he's now denied that. But so when it started, it was very much this, the idea was that this was going to be a digital currency and that it was going to be used to pay for things. And the kind of, its selling point was that it was peer-to-peer digital currency that could be sent across the world without a third party to approve it. And so that really was, you know, some people say that it was never actually intended to be used as a currency, but a lot of people think it was. And that's certainly how it was kind of written up in the white paper in 2009, which is when, you know, it kind of was born out of the financial crisis. So that's kind of taking us right back to the start. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin.
But we don't, sorry, I just want to pick you up. We don't even know who started it. Is that
We don't. So it's someone called Satoshi Nakamoto, and there have been various kind of like moments when, for example, Time magazine thought that they found him at one point.
So he's like the Banksy of cryptocurrency. Is it?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, he or she might be dead. There have been all sorts of, as I say, there's been all sorts of kind of theories. There was this guy called Craig Wright, this Australian guy who came out and said that he was Satoshi back in kind of 2016, I want to say, around that time anyway. And then, you know, most people believe that that was a massive lie. And so anyway, there's been all sorts of theories. Peter Todd is the latest one. He's apparently had to go into hiding after this HBO documentary said that he was the creator, because he's saying he's not. It's not clear that he's a computer, a developer who was known about in the Bitcoin world, but he's always said he wasn't Satoshi. But so it was created by this mysterious person or entity. We don't really know who. And as I say, the idea was that this would be a currency. But as, you know, as it started being used, it turned out that actually it was quite a poor currency for a lot of reasons, because it didn't really fulfill any of the things that you would want a currency to do. It didn't really fulfill the criteria, so it didn't have things like stability. It was like very unstable, because you need to have quite a lot of liquidity. In other words, a lot of people have to be using something in order for the price to kind of become stable. Another thing, and so that means that, you know, you might pay for something, you know, for one Bitcoin, and then the next day it's worth double or it's worth half. So you could have waited, you know, so there's no incentive to spend it, because maybe it's going to increase in value. You know, it's a bit like if inflation was suddenly going crazy. It's kind of, it completely skews the incentives around spending. And famously, the first ever Bitcoin transaction was for pizza. I think it was 10,000 Bitcoins that were used to buy two pizzas, which is now like either billions or hundreds of millions. Sorry, I haven't got the maths in front of me, but it's like, you can imagine, mm-hmm. I mean, currently Bitcoin is at like 67,000. So times that by 10,000. So I guess in the hundreds of millions, is that? I can't do it. I can't do the maths on the spot. And so it suddenly became clear, or sorry, not suddenly, it gradually became clear that this wasn't a very, very useful currency. But what it was quite a good way of making money. Mm. And as I say, when it was used, you know, if you had bought a Bitcoin when it was being used to buy a two pizzas for $10,000 and held onto it until now, you would have a, you know, you would have made a, you know, God knows how many thousands of percent increase in your investment. In, you know, you would have had a huge return on your investment. So anyway, people started to notice, because it was quite unknown at the beginning. And so the more people who came into the market, the more the price went up, because obviously price is determined by demand, supply and demand. And Bitcoin has this quite kind of cleverly controlled supply, actually, that was set up by Satoshi Nakamoto, in which there's, I won't go into the real mechanics of it because it's quite complex, but there's a certain amount of Bitcoins added to the system roughly every 10 minutes. And that amount gets less over time. But again, it's all a bit complex. But
yeah, the principle is it's added to, but it's a diminishing commodity, if
exactly.
you like. But initially, they got very excited about it. It was sort of a closed shop. It was very complex. We won't even go in to the issue of NFTs, which we covered on this show and nearly broke us. But then it was out of favor, it was out of fashion. And back in 2022, we were all kind of saying, look, that's sort of dead and gone. Where is it now?
It seems to kind of sadly really be neither dead nor gone. And I should say, by the way, that if NFTs almost broke you, that's a good sign. That's a sign that you are, that, you know, of intelligence, I would say, because it does, all of this stuff really does make no sense, in my opinion. I'm quite a hardened skeptic around all of this. And I started off with a very open mind. But essentially, what you're talking about is a string of ones and zeros, you know, an abstract digital kind of thing that with nothing, absolutely nothing underneath it apart from belief.
Mm.
And that criticism is always met with, well, that's the same for fiat-based money. In other words, that's the same for our currency that we use, because we're no longer on the gold standard. And that's true. But in those cases, we have a nation state behind them. So we know our currencies are no longer based on gold, but they are based on
a fungible currency. Charlie, can I bring you back in here just to get your views on that crypto broader issue? And we'll get back to the Coulsons and Stripe in a moment. But you remember and you recall those discussions we had around the NFTs. Where do you see cryptocurrency at? And do you see that this issue, Stripe getting in on this with the stablecoins, is a sort of a game-changing moment to either reinvent it, reinvigorate it? What do you think?
I think, I mean, what we're seeing, I mean, I touched on it earlier, you know, crypto, you know, becoming more acceptable, you know, and I don't know about the future, say, for Bitcoin or for variations of that, but we're beginning to see crypto in some way, digital assets, if you prefer, becoming more acceptable. I mean, you're even seeing it, the EU is working on a digital euro, which would be, it would just be another way to make payments. The idea is not that it would replace notes and coins, but it would just serve as another alternative way to pay for things. And, you know, I mean, you know, there's already preparation being undertaken on that, you know, and the EU's by far and away, you know, not the only ones doing this. I mean, this is being looked at by governments across the world, you know. So we are looking, I think, at some stage, we are going to increasingly see crypto becoming a part of our world, whether we like it or not, you know. And I think, but what it will be is, I think it'll be a treading very carefully. There may be something like a digital euro come along in a few years' time that will coexist with, you know, traditional currency, and, you know, that we will adopt slowly but surely, you know. And as I touched on, stablecoins is a sort of a bridge towards that, I think.
Yeah. Jemima, just to bring you back in on the regulation side of the cryptocurrencies as well, the US Securities and Exchange Commission, obviously a huge part of this, where are these cryptocurrencies now in terms of regulation and listing?
Well, I would just quickly like to push back against what was just said there, because I don't believe that that just because these central banks are working on digital, you know, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, that this is in any way any kind of endorsement or kind of move towards adoption of crypto. We need to separate three different things. One is cryptocurrencies that trade according to the whims of the market. Another one is stable coins, which are tied to the value of existing currencies. And therefore, the only likeness they have to crypto is that they are using the same blockchain technology and they exist outside of kind of regulated entities, although there is work on regulating those. And the third thing is central bank issued digital currencies. So those are three things. A digital euro would be the latter. Mm. And to be working on the latter is no endorsement of the first thing, crypto. And in fact, the SEC approving Bitcoin ETFs was also not an endorsement of Bitcoin. It was just that they didn't really have an argument to make. But given that the financial sector did seem to want to be able to have a safer exposure to crypto, and you can understand why, because crypto, the upside of crypto is kind of unlimited, given that it's based on absolutely nothing. If you imagine, like, what is this thing worth? Well, it could be worth anything if more people get into it. And the downside is obviously 100%, but the upside is more than 100%. So it makes sense to allocate potentially 1% of your portfolio if you've got billions of dollars that you're managing. That was why it was accepted. But I just wanted to be clear that I don't think that therefore means that regulators in the US are kind of putting a stamp of approval or legitimacy.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. It's just a way of diversifying portfolios, maybe, and also responding to consumer demand. And basically,
yeah, I think it's worth adding on that as well. You know, just with Jemima touching on that, is you know, the U.S. securities regulator, the SEC, has been very hard on, if you like, crypto. You know, and the exchanges that have been, you know, dealing in it. I mean, you know, they're certainly not fans of it, as Jemima touched on there.
Mm. Well, I was just going to say that I think with Trump, you know, things might easily change. And I think that's the reason that we've seen Bitcoin doing quite well in recent weeks, because he has been making so many noises about Bitcoin. Obviously, he's a complete, you know, we don't even need to go into the words that he is, but he is, you know, doesn't seem to have many ideological viewpoints that can't change on anything, really, because he kind of seems to be driven more by things like self-interest. And so clearly, given that there's a huge amount of lobbying money now in crypto, because they've made billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. And so these massive companies are now able to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying. And so, of course, he's going to say he supports crypto, because that means that he's not only getting money from the industry, he's also getting support and kind of is able to show himself as this kind of tech-savvy kind of president. So I do think that under a Trump presidency, which unfortunately is looking more and more likely, we will probably see the US soften its stance on crypto, particularly because he said he's going to, you know, put in a new SEC chair, and you know, he wants to kind of deregulate all of that.
Well, he wants to take over the Federal Reserve as well. So, well, why would he stop at regulating Bitcoin? But I think you're right. That's a really salient point, that these tech companies are becoming much more organized and adept at lobbying for regulation. So that's obviously something that's feeding into politics now in a way that it mightn't have done a couple of years ago. Charlie, I want to go back to you for the final word on this and the Coulson brothers. And we talk a little bit about numbers. What are they predicting for this, or what are they likely to do with an investment of 1.1 billion, which is their biggest acquisition? What are they hoping to get back?
Yeah, they haven't said. There's no touch. They haven't even confirmed the figure that's been that's alleged to be the sum that's been paid for Bridge, which is 1.1 billion, according to reports. But what they're definitely looking to do is to continue to grow. I mean, you know, it's really interesting whenever you talk to the Collisons, whenever they're featured in the news, they often kind of talk along the lines of, we're only just getting started, you know, and you can see that, you know, the users processed 1 trillion between them all on Stripe last year, which is equivalent to about 1% of global GDP. But, you know, as they touch on it, it's like online payments, we tend to think of them being very commonplace now. Their argument is that we're only just beginning in terms of online payments, and that they are their best place to kind of, you know, take advantage of that. So it's very much, it plays into their thing of like, widens their user base. Customers, as I said, are looking to use stable coins more. So that to become a feature of what's happening. So they are there just very much embracing that. They're, I think by in Bridge, they are very much kind of putting themselves right at the forefront of stable coins.
Well, extraordinary success stories, extraordinary numbers. Before I let you go, Jemima, Kelly, that's a good Irish name. Do you have any Irish connections?
I do indeed. My father was Irish, Dubliner, and I have lots of family still in Dublin, including, do you know the band The Fat Lady Sings?
We do know the band The Fat Lady Sings.
Well, the lead singer is my cousin, Nick Kelly. What a man.
There you go. Well, the connections.
That's my biggest Irish claim to fame.
Excellent.
And it's a great band. Jemima, thank you very much. And Charlie, thank you also for joining me today. That was Charlie Taylor of the Business Post and Jemima Kelly, columnist with the Financial Times.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Taking Stock on News Talk. Now, happy bank holiday. Elections are on the way. And in those elections, we often hear calls for more of these bank holidays. After the break, we'll find out exactly how much they cost and whether they benefit our economy. Don't go anywhere. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. Now, take a listen to this.
Bank holidays, brilliant, and we do them better than anybody. And I was in the UK recently, and they take their bank holidays really seriously. Yeah, bank holiday, it's one day. It's just one day. Yeah. One day, Monday, go to bed a bit late on Sunday, go walk the dog, have a pizza, watch a film, get up, you know, go to bed, get up for work. Achoo, who's day? Irish people will be looking on going, no, you're doing it wrong. You have to make a festival out of it. And you have to get ready for a day off by doing feck all for a few days beforehand. Irish people like to tie a bit of string around the bank holiday Monday, pull it back through time to the previous Wednesday, and start getting lazy then, because there's a day off coming. I have to start doing nothing in your job. Oh, jeez, I don't care. Bank holiday on the way, a day off, so I'll do nothing for the next few days. That phone's been ringing all day. I don't care. I never wanted to join the guards anyway.
And that's the fabulous Irish comedian John Colleary there. Yes, the great October bank holiday weekend. And we hope you're enjoying yours. Well, have you ever thought about how much a bank holiday weekend costs our economy? I bet you haven't. But as we head into a general election campaign, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that although we have 10 public holidays here in Ireland, somebody is about to suggest yet another one. Well, my next guest has been looking at the data around this issue, and I'm delighted to welcome Edward Thomas Jones, lecturer in economics at Bangor University, to Taking Stock. Now, Edward, you started to look at this. Why?
Well, first of all, in Wales, we haven't got a bank holiday, a public holiday to celebrate our patron saint. And we're always having this discussion, should we have one or not? And the question naturally arises then, what impact it would have on the economy. So I started looking at, well, what impact do these holidays have on the economy, thinking about Wales itself. And I started exploring the impact in different countries and the overall analysis there. And it's quite a fascinating country to explore.
Mm. And what did you find out? What were the other countries you looked at?
Well, the two main ones that stick to mind was Italy and Australia. And it's interesting because in Italy, it was found that public holidays were found to have a positive effect on the economy, and in Australia it was negative. And you really have to dig in deeper to truly understand the impact of these type of holidays on the economy. And unfortunately, it's not clear, even despite all the work that's been done, it's not clear what impact they do have on the economy.
Yeah, indeed. In our own government, they have had several different reports examining it, and they have come up with a figure, actually a suggested figure of 226 million is what they say, 0.0% of GDP is what it would cost for an additional day of a public holiday. But they do make the point that actually it's very difficult to try and assess the sectoral benefits versus maybe the public health benefits or the feel-good factor that some people have just from getting a rest.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've seen the Australian example was great in that there were some studies that showed it had a positive impact on the economy. There were others that showed it had a negative impact. I think what's important is What do people do on this extra day of holiday? You know, if they take time to reconnect with family and friends, maybe go for a walk, look after their own mental health, then, you know, clearly when they go back to the workplace afterwards, they are far more productive. And, you know, it's very difficult to put numbers on that, but we know that's what will happen. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of the analysis, that's what they failed to capture, that mental health benefit that people get from these holidays.
And what are the type of sectors or industries that we know actually do get a bounce from a public holiday when it is happening?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it depends on the state of the economy. So if the economy is booming and if people have disposable income, so they have a spare bit cash to spend, then clearly tourism, retail, recreation and hospitality, they tend to be the industries that do benefit. Others then finance and construction, you know, they lose a day. And so they suffer because of these holidays. But again, it varies depending on the state of the economy. If things are going well, then yeah, clearly tourism, retail, they are main winners. But if it's not, if people are struggling just to pay everyday bills, nobody really wins from the bank holidays.
And I was reading in the piece that you wrote about it that domestic tourism itself is an important factor, because if you're promoting, if you're a country like Ireland, we're very lucky, we're tourism is our biggest industry now. We've got lots of things to see and do. Our national agency is constantly promoting and coming up with new things. So the domestic tourism market as it stands is an important part of this as well.
Yeah, and it depends if people have the money to spend on the holiday. It's fantastic having that industry ready to go. But what you need, though, is people within the country with money to spend when that holiday comes, so that the tourism, recreation and hospitality industries, they really do benefit at that time. Unfortunately, we know the economy goes through cycles, and that's not going to be the case every year. But and that's why it's been so difficult to conclude, you know, what impact a public holiday has on the economy. In some years, it does have that positive benefit, on others it's a negative benefit. So what I concluded at the end of my work was we don't actually know what the impact on the economy is. It's a very difficult thing to measure, and therefore when people decide if they want a public holiday, it's far more important to consider, why do we want to celebrate this day? What's the reason behind this celebration? And ignore the economic impact behind it, because that will change year on year.
Well, that in itself is an interesting conclusion, Edward, because now we know that there's just two things in the world you can't put a price on. One is love and the other is a public holiday. But let's look at the numbers in terms of how many public holidays we have. I mentioned at the top of the item here, we have 10 here in Ireland, and you know, everybody always wants more. Politicians are probably about to promise us a few more. What about the UK? You mentioned Wales, you don't have one for your day, but what are the numbers like there?
Yeah, so in Wales and England, we have 8 at the moment. I from what I saw, 12 was kind of the normal for Europe. Finland, they have 15, which is...
that's very generous.
That's very generous. But, you know, on the whole, it's around 12 that seems to be, yeah, on average for each country goes for. You know, I would say England or Wales really are behind the curve on this, and I suspect we could do with a bit more public holidays. Of course, we did have that the Queen Platinum Jubilee 2022 that was introduced. You know, we considered what impact that had on the economy. Again, looking at that, it was very difficult to say if it did have a positive or negative impact on the economy. So yeah, we need more, but not for economic reasons.
But it's interesting that you mentioned quite a few times earlier on that, like, the type of quality of a bank holiday that a family might experience depends on their own financial circumstances. And that's the same for governments, right? You know, who need this money flowing through the economy to boost sectors like tourism, but also have to take in other sectors like the building industry, as you mentioned, maybe farming and things like that, who lose employees on the day. And so if you look at the UK now and all of the struggles that are happening there with the economy and the Labour Party at pains to point out that they're in, you know, dire trouble, it's hardly likely that a government with that on its hands is going to be able to dole out more public holidays to the people there, really, is it?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because I can see the economic argument for not having a public holiday in the UK. But having said that, if we think about the UK, what it's gone through over the last few years, we've had the uncertainty of Brexit that caused a lot of tension in the country. We had the pandemic the same way as everybody else, the cost of living crisis. And I suspect people just need that one extra day now just to have a bit of relaxation and look after their own mental health. And maybe it's a case for the government to decide, you know what, this could have a negative impact on the economy, but it's what the people need. They just need that break given everything that everyone's been going through.
Well, look, I think that we should end there on a high, and the suggestion that maybe that's something the government could look at. And I hope that we do all enjoy our bank holiday weekend this weekend. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Edward Thomas Jones, lecturer in economics at Bangor University. Thank you very much, Edward, for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is News Talks Taking Stock. After the break, we'll be trying to explain the complex US electoral system of voting. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn to the US and the elections, of course. All this year, we've been covering the elections here on Taking Stock. We've had some fabulous contributors from The Guardian, from The Financial Times, from The Hill. We've even had Lawrence Donegan on the trail of the campaign across the US. But today, we wanted to do something slightly different. So we're not going to have any political analysis as such or any campaign news. Instead, we wanted to look at how the election in America actually works. And in particular, I want to talk about the Electoral College system and how it's key to choosing a president. So to help me do just that, I'm delighted to be joined from New York now by Sam Levine, who's from The Guardian, and we're going to go through what the Electoral College is. Sam, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Mandy. Very happy to be here.
Now, Sam, I was on a panel during the week discussing the American elections, and one of the people in the audience said they just didn't understand the fundamental question of why somebody can win a popular vote and still lose an election. So that kind of started me off thinking about, you know, we need to explain this to people so that we can understand. So we're going to start off with exactly what the Electoral College is.
The Electoral College is this strange quirk that we have in the United States that sets up a system where it is possible that the person who gets the most votes does not win the election. It's a very strange thought, especially one in a democracy. So this is something that was established in the U.S. Constitution. It's always existed in the U.S. It was born out of compromise at the Constitutional Convention. And it essentially says that the U.S. president is formally elected by a set of electors that come from each state. And typically, those electors are chosen by the party. There's a slate for the Democratic candidate. There's a slate for the Republican candidate. And each state gets a number of electors that's proportional to the number of representatives that they have in Congress. So if a state has, you know, 15 members of Congress, they get 15 electoral votes. And to win the presidential election, you need to get a majority of the Electoral College, which is 270 electoral votes, which is the magic number that both candidates are shooting for this and every election cycle.
Mm. And then in that system, the Constitution says that state legislators can choose who and how they want to award their electors. But there are some states that don't go the same way as the others.
That's right. States can choose how they want to award their electors. And with two notable exceptions, every state gives the winner of their statewide popular vote all of their electors. So if you're in Georgia and you win the popular vote in Georgia, you get all of the state's electoral college votes. Pretty straightforward.
Mm.
There are two states, Maine and Nebraska, that have a different system. They split up the way that they award their electoral college votes. The winner of the statewide votes gets a portion of the electors, and then they allocate the remaining electors, I think it's one in Maine and two in Nebraska, by congressional districts. So the winner of certain congressional districts will get their electors.
Mm. Now, look, just to go back, you mentioned there the founding fathers, and they created this system and it has existed since then. But why did they choose this particular method? Why is there no superseding of the popular vote for the ultimate winner?
Well, at the Constitutional Convention, there was a big debate over, you know, what to do about slaves and how slaves should be treated for purposes of counting population. And there was this, you know, it's really a stain on American history, but there was this racist compromise that essentially black people in the United States would be counted as 3/5 of a person for population purposes. And when it came time to, you know, figure out how to select a president, there was some debate over doing a direct popular vote. But the southern states didn't want to do that because, they had less voters there. And obviously the black population there couldn't vote. So they wanted some way that would preserve their population influence, but that would that wouldn't diminish the say that they had in the national vote. So, you know, the Electoral College was this sort of compromise that preserved, all of those interests. And I think at the time, we're talking about the 18th century, there was also some concern that if you just did direct popular vote, that people across the country, you know, wouldn't be able to hear from all the candidates. It was pragmatically difficult, and that, you know, their passions could be swayed by, you know, misleading rhetoric and things like that. So it was really something that they dealt with at the end of the convention hasn't been changed since then.
Mm. It is very interesting, though, isn't it, that since its inception, that idea and issue of race has been at the core of the American Constitution. And so we've almost come full circle, if you like, when now we're facing presidential elections where race again is at the core, still not resolved.
That's right. And I think there are increasing calls to do something about the Electoral College. Abolishing it entirely would take a constitutional amendment. You know, it's outlined in the Constitution. But I think there's increasing awareness of that this is a system that is outdated, that, you know, is based on a legacy of racism in the United States, and especially when it comes to choosing a president, that this may not be the best way to do it. And I think that criticism has been amplified by the fact that, you know, since 2000, there have been two elections, one in the year 2001 and 2016, where the winner of the national popular vote was not elected president of the United States. And that just fundamentally to a lot of people seems incompatible with a democracy where the fundamental principle is that the person who gets the most votes wins.
Yeah, and you might explain that to us a little bit more, because in 2016, there was an awful lot of shock about Donald Trump winning over Hillary Clinton when she won the popular vote. But it is back to that magic number and understanding that the candidate needs to get 270 votes for them from this Electoral College, which is what makes it so important.
Right. And what's happened in our politics here is that the vast majority of U.S. states have become pretty solidified in how they are going to vote. You know, 43 of the states, it's pretty clear who they'll vote for in this election. So both candidates are really competing for voters in just seven states. We call them the swing states because they could swing either way. So it really allows a very small fraction of Americans to get to choose who the president is. And the candidates are, you know, especially attuned to voters from those areas, but not the rest of the country. They hardly travel to, you know, other states outside of the swing states. And it really just diminishes the campaign to just a handful of states and a handful of voters.
Yeah. And on those seven swing states, we might just mention there, Pennsylvania this time, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, Nevada. Now, I read the other day, there's 128 permutations of how they could make those, that magic number of 270. But are the swing states always the same or do they change, Sam?
The swing states do change over time. I mean, I think if you 20 years ago, you know, everyone in America was focused on Florida as a swing state, and it's not really considered a swing state in this election. It's pretty solidly Republican. Michigan, by contrast, you know, was considered a pretty solid Democratic state until 2016 when Donald Trump won it. So changing demographics, changing population can either solidify a state as going one way or the other, or turn a state into a swing state. But it's really come down to just a handful of states that are really competitive in the presidential election now.
And you tend to see candidates really focus on those swing states wherever they are in for the vast majority of their campaign, actually. And then the idea that the Electoral College that we spoke of at the beginning and their vote and where that goes ultimately, that's what I would like to look at next. And to do that, I'd like to just revisit the 2020 election result and that awful day of January the 6th on Capitol Hill when Donald Trump was urging Mike Pence, his then vice president, not to proceed with the vote. Can you just talk to me a little bit about what the electorals have to do once they get to that stage in the Congress when they're there and they're representing their state? Do they have to vote for a specific candidate?
Right. So after the presidential election, about a month afterwards, on the same day, it's in December, all of the electors meet usually in the state capitol building and they vote and sign a certificate that says we are the electors from Georgia or wherever, and we are awarding, you know, our electoral votes to Donald Trump or Kamala Harris or whoever, and then they send that certificate to Washington. This happens after all the votes are counted, the vote is certified, you know, it's official, and this is really seen as a pro forma step. There was some litigation at the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago whether states had the right to punish faithless electors who didn't vote how they were supposed to. And it was ruled that states can do that, that an elector can be removed if they don't vote how they're, you know, they've pledged to vote. But in 2020, the theory from the Trump campaign was this idea that they could contest the vote from the electors, that they could, even if Joe Biden had won a state, that the Trump campaign could appoint an alternate slate of electors and send that slate to Congress, and that Congress could choose which slate it wanted to count. This is obviously a fringe, ridiculous idea. You know, you can't just lose an election, decide that you may have won the election, and leave it up to members of Congress to choose. And the Trump campaign was arguing that, you know, Congress had more discretion over which votes to count. They wanted Mike Pence to refuse to count the legitimate slates of electors and count the alternate slates. And that was shut down by Mike Pence, by members of Congress. And, you know, Joe Biden was seated as the winner of the election.
Yeah, and to his credit, Mike Pence did restore and convene the meeting on the day and went ahead with that, even though insurrection had just taken place. Just before I let you go, Sam, I just want to see if the Electoral College, the system itself, why it's been successful in remaining in place for so long. And has there ever been a time when it looked like they might do something like change the constitution on it?
There have been various efforts to change the Electoral College. None have been successful so far. I think, you know, in my research on this, I think there have been almost 1,000 efforts to change the Electoral College since 1800. And the Congressional Research Service said as recently as 2019, there were 700 efforts. But, you know, various politicians for various reasons haven't gotten on board with the idea of doing away with it. And, you know, I think that the Electoral College has continued to support the influence of, you know, a handful of states. It's given them a lot of importance. So they haven't gone along with the idea of getting rid of it.
All right. Well, it's here to stay for the longer term. We'll certainly be in place for the 5th of November when we'll all be watching on. Well, Sam, thank you very much. You've cleared up an awful lot for me. That was Sam Levine from The Guardian. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Anytime.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks, as always, to today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy, Stephen Daunt and Simon Keemer on research, and Hugo De Silva-Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more, no doubt. But for me, Mandy Johnston, that was Taking Stock. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.